Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode Forward Thinkers. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und mein heutiger Gast ist Stefan Gehene. Der Neurobiologe und Autor des Bestsellers The Hungry Brain beschäftigt sich intensiv mit der Wissenschaft hinter dem Essverhalten. Er erklärt, warum unser Gehirn nicht darauf ausgelegt ist, schlank zu bleiben, weshalb hochverarbeitete Lebensmittel uns zum Überessen verleiten und warum klassische Diäten oft scheitern. Ich wollte von ihm wissen, welche Rolle unser Gehirn tatsächlich bei der Gewichtskontrolle spielt, warum Willenskraft allein selten ausreicht und welche Ansätze wirklich funktionieren, um langfristig gesund zu essen. Wenn dir diese Episode von Forward Thinkers gefällt, folge uns bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer du gerne Podcasts hörst und hinterlasse uns eine gute Bewertung.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Stefan, I'm so happy to meet you today to speak about neuroscience, about biology, about obesity, about diets and nutrition. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Daniel.
So before we dive deeper into the topic, a rather personal question. What actually sparked your fascination with the science of overeating and obesity in the first place? Was there some moment that changed your perspective on that?
Yeah, so I did my graduate research on neurodegenerative disease, and I was studying a disease that is quite rare called spinocerebellar ataxia type 7. And I joke that there are more people studying this disease than there are that actually have the disease. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration, but not much of one. And so I developed a craving for doing something that was more impactful on a larger number of people. And obesity, especially in the United States, but also globally, is very impactful. And I came to understand during my graduate work that it has a lot to do with neuroscience, and also that a lot of people don't realize it has a lot to do with neuroscience. So bringing together my interest in neuroscience with my interest in impact, that's really the intersection that caused my interest in obesity.
You described the brain as the key player in weight regulation. So if our brains are so finely tuned to control body weight, why do so many people struggle with obesity today?
Yeah, I mean, our brains are not optimized to maintain a lean weight in the modern food environment. I think that's the first thing to be clear about. Our brains are optimized to regulate body fatness in the ancestral environment that we evolved in. But even there, I mean, the control of body fatness is not perfect. We do have regulatory systems, but obviously they're not designed to maintain a lean body for our entire lives, at least in the context that we currently live in. And so really, taking a broader perspective, the brain determines our eating behavior, the brain influences our energy expenditure, how many calories our body burns, and the brain regulates body fatness, and those things come together to determine the amount of body fatness that we have. But some of the things the brain is doing that impact body fatness have nothing to do with regulating body fatness. So for example, we crave certain types of foods. We might have cravings for rich, sweet, calorie-dense desserts after a meal that we've already eaten enough calories at. You know, we've eaten as much as we need for our bodies at that meal, and then the dessert comes out and we're ready to eat more. That process has nothing to do with trying to regulate body fatness. It has to do with the brain seeing a high-value food item that it has labeled as high value, and wanting you to ingest that. So the brain has a lot to do with our body fatness, but not all of that has to do with regulating our body fatness to keep it at a level that we would consider optimal for health or even, you know, physical attractiveness.
If we take a look at our modern Western world food environment, what are the most damaging aspects of today's diet from a neurological perspective?
Yeah, I think that there are a few things that come together. The first one that I will cite is that our food does not create a lot of satiety per calorie. So satiety is a technical term for fullness. So when we eat food, depending on what we're eating, some types of food will make us feel more full per calorie than others. And there are properties that relate to this, like protein. Higher protein makes us feel more full. Lower calorie density makes us feel more full per calorie, which is a little bit counterintuitive. Higher fiber makes us feel more full per calorie. And these are properties that impact the digestive system as they enter our bodies. And that information from our digestive system is collected by the brain, particularly a brain region called the brainstem, and particularly a part of the brainstem called the NTS, nucleus tractus solitarius. And this signal is kind of builds up as you eat. And once it reaches a certain level, it shuts off your desire to consume food. And so depending on what type of food you're eating, it may have more or less satiety per calorie. And the foods that have the least satiety per calorie are the foods that we kind of tend to associate with being fattening junk foods, like sweet desserts and pizza and, you know, white bread with butter, pastries, candy, that sort of thing. Those types of foods have very low satiety per calorie. And then the foods that we think of as kind of unrefined, less processed, more traditional foods like plain meats, fresh fruits, whole grains like oatmeal, porridge, foods like that, eggs, those are the types of foods that tend to have a higher satiety per calorie. And if you look historically at how our diets have changed over time, this is especially true in the US, but also, of course, true to some extent in European countries, is you see a transition from simpler, less processed foods toward more highly processed, lower satiety foods. And not only that, but food has become more ubiquitous and more accessible. So food, you know, we like to complain about the cost of food, but historically speaking, food is very cheap today by historical standards. And not only that, it's everywhere. And I think, again, this is a place where the United States is kind of the front runner here, but I think that's true in a lot of places to some extent, is it's everywhere. Food is everywhere. It's in the checkout lane at the hardware store. It's, you know, everywhere you go, it's extremely abundant. And so the effort barrier to eating is very, very low. If you think about the ancestral human environment when we were hunter-gatherers, if you want to eat something, you might have to walk for miles, you might have to climb a tree, you might have to, you know, run after an animal or dig up tubers, harvest small berries for a long time. The effort barriers were really quite substantial to eating. And today the effort barrier is almost zero. So, you know, the brain is designed to be opportunistic. And if the opportunity is right there and it's very easy and it's something desirable, you know, food that your brain wants, it's not surprising that you're going to take the opportunity and that it might be difficult to resist engaging in that eating behavior.
So the original programming of our brain more or less overrides our best intentions?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think the brain contains these modules that determine our motivation and our eating behavior. Modules like the ones that determine satiety, the ones that are regulating your body fat level, the ones that are setting your cravings and determining how seductive food is to you. And these things were calibrated in an ancestral environment where food was much more scarce. These brain systems were calibrated back then. And these are, by and large, these are mostly non-conscious brain systems. So these are not systems that you can flip a switch on in your brain. You can't say, oh, I'm going to turn off hunger now because I don't want to feel hungry. You can't say, I don't want to experience this craving for this brownie I'm smelling right now or these cookies because I'm not hungry and I don't think that's a healthy food. These are things that arise from non-conscious parts of the brain, whether we want them to or not. And then we have to deal with those motivations. And so these are non-conscious modules that evolved and are just calibrated for a different environment. And because they were calibrated in an environment of scarcity, when they're in an environment of abundance, they're going to tend to push us to overconsume.
Over the last couple of years, we've seen a whole new pharmaceutical trend with solutions like Ozempic or Wegovy for weight loss. Do you see those drugs as a breakthrough, or are they merely a symptom of a deeper societal problem?
I mean, they can be both, right? So, I mean, I think there absolutely is a social problem that stems from our food environment. Our food environment is a double-edged sword. We have, in the modern world, the safest, most abundant food system ever to exist in the modern affluent world, right? Like, at least in the US and Europe, you don't have to worry very much that your food is going to be contain toxic substances or contain pathogens. And that's something our ancestors had to worry a lot about, right? They got sick all the time eating food and water that was contaminated with various things. So in some ways, we have this amazing, cheap, abundant food system. But, you know, the other edge of the sword is that there are downsides to that abundance and to that, to having so much, you know, desirable calorie-dense food around. And so, you know, I think that is a problem. So and a symptom of that is that we have a lot of obesity, and then we've come up with this technological solution to what is a technological problem. But, you know, it's like, what's our alternative? Like, we're not going to go back to becoming hunter-gatherers, right? I don't think anyone wants that. And even, you know, that's maybe an unfair example, because there are probably things we could do to our food environment that would help without having to become hunter-gatherers. But it's very difficult for me to imagine us reversing the obesity epidemic via changes to the food environment, because I don't think people are willing to go to the extent that we would need to go to reverse the obesity epidemic. Because I think it would be a fairly radical shift in our food system. And I don't think people want that. And so I think we have a problem that comes from affluence and technology that maybe we could help to some degree, but I don't think it's going to get reversed completely by changing the food environment. I don't think the government has enough power, enough mandate in, you know, European or American countries to do what it would take to reverse it. And so what we're left with are technological solutions to a technological problem. And I think that the GLP-1 drugs are an excellent, or at least the best that we have, technological solution to the problem. And because the brain is the primary organ that determines body fatness, it's not surprising that these drugs act in the brain. The primary target of these drugs are satiety circuits in the brainstem, the same circuits we were talking about for satiety per calorie. And essentially, they just turn up the knob on satiety. They may do more than that, but I think that's a central action that they have. And so the same amount of food will make you feel twice as full, and you end up eating only 3/4 as much.
If we take a look at our brain and evolution, if there is a group of people, can you see evolutionary differences between them in how our brain interacts with food and body fat? Is there like an evolutionary adaptation to today's diet, with some people being further down the road of evolution and others struggling more?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there has clearly been genetic adaptation to diet over historical time. You can see this, for example, in lactase persistence. So the ancestral human condition is that after you're done breastfeeding, you lose the ability to digest lactose. And after that, milk, you're lactose intolerant. But many populations, including most Europeans, at some point evolved a gene that allows that lactase enzyme to be secreted into adulthood. So now we can drink milk for our whole lives. And so there are genetics adaptations to diet clearly that have happened over time. But I mean, the modern fattening food environment is really very recent. We're talking about mostly the last century, and even it's accelerated. You know, I would say even the worst part of it, or the most impactful part of it, has really just been the last 50 years. And so I don't think there's been time for a lot of genetic adaptation. And if you look at, so obesity is not really a very deadly condition. So it's not really causing very many people to die or become infertile before reproducing. And so there's not really there's not much selection against it genetically happening. If you look at, you can actually look at this genetically in genetic studies and say, is there positive or negative selection happening with obesity? So are obesity related genes getting taken out of the gene pool? Are they being actually favored? And there's not really much evidence that I've seen that they're being taken out of the gene pool. If anything, studies are showing that it's neutral or they're being favored. So I don't think there's a lot of adaptation in that respect happening to the modern fattening diet. Yeah.
If you would ask people that are not too familiar with the science around that topic, most people would argue that weight loss is a mix between your diet and movement and sports. How do those two factors play together in, like, from a scientific point of view?
Yeah, there is debate about the role of physical activity. And so I want to acknowledge that there's some uncertainty here. My view is that they both matter, but diet matters more than physical activity. When we're talking strictly about body fat level, physical activity is very important for health. I think it's really important for healthy aging. But when we're strictly talking about how much body fat you have, it seems pretty clear. I think there's pretty universal agreement that diet is a more powerful lever over body fatness than physical activity. And then physical activity, some people would say, yeah, it's fairly impactful. Some people would say it doesn't matter at all. And I think I'm kind of in the middle where I would say it does impact body fatness. And I think there's pretty good evidence that it does. But the impact is simply not as large as you see with dietary modifications. And furthermore, I would say not only is the impact smaller, but the amount of effort you have to take to get to that impact is a lot larger than by modifying your diet. So, you know, to get a substantial amount of fat loss with exercise, you might need to be exercising for hours each week. And for someone who's currently sedentary, that's a pretty big commitment, right? That's a lot of effort. Whereas with diet, eating is something you're already doing. And yeah, there might be some sacrifice involved. There will be some sacrifice involved in dieting, but I think it tends to be less difficult than committing to a major exercise program for most people.
You already talked about the different effects of different diets and food we are taking in. If we look at someone who's trying to lose weight, and maybe the first thing that this person is doing is like just eating less, skipping different meals, maybe no lunch, no breakfast, whatever, just having like dinner or having like just two meals per day instead of three, and getting rid of all the stuff and the snacks in between. Can there also be like a negative effect to how our brain decides on our body fat when we are eating less instead of like eating the right stuff with like three meals per day?
Yeah. So I think that the main mechanism that causes the weight loss is a reduction in calorie intake. So one way or another, if you want to lose fat via diet, you want to be eating fewer calories. But there are different ways you can envision doing that. And so you're drawing a contrast between not changing the types of foods you're eating, but just changing the amount, versus changing the types of foods that you're eating and getting a calorie reduction effect naturally from that. Yeah. And I mean, either approach will work if you can stick to it. So it's not that one, you know, if you can reduce your calorie intake by 20%, you will absolutely lose fat. But the problem is that if you're not changing the types of things that you're eating and you're not changing your food environment, that's going to be difficult to maintain. you're going to get a lot of pushback from these brain modules that, you know, let me put it this way. The diet that you are at without trying to lose weight, that's the equilibrium that your brain has reached, that these modules have reached in your life. And if you try to cut back on that by just eating less, by exerting cognitive control over these non-conscious circuits, you're going to be struggling against those circuits because they're not at equilibrium. They're not where they want to be in your life and in your diet. So you're setting up a battle between your, you know, conscious, rational, willpower brain and the parts of your brain that are generating hunger, the parts that are generating cravings, etc., the parts that are being opportunistic when there's food on the table. And that's just a struggle. It's difficult. And most people are not able to sustain that. And that's what we see in diet trials. So it's not to say that it wouldn't work if you could sustain it. It's just harder to sustain. Whereas if you are eating, if you have a food environment that's set up where you're not presenting temptations to yourself often, or you're creating little effort barriers to eating, and then the food that you are eating creates more satiety per calorie, you're going to be eating to fullness at each meal and feeling satisfied, but you will have naturally eaten fewer calories. And so that way, the way I think about it is you're creating more of an alignment between these different brain systems, your willpower, rational brain system, and your hunger system and your craving system. These things are all in alignment and they're not fighting against each other. And so to me, that's an easier and more sustainable situation.
But there is no like mechanism in our brain that would make our brain think that it has to build more body fat if we are changing from a habit with like three proper meals per day into like only one meal per day, that our brain is somehow deciding that we have to keep more kind of or build more body fat out of the meals we are getting because there's so much time in between till we get the next meal.
Well, I'm not aware of that happening on the basis of meal timing. It is true that when you start losing weight, once you've lost a certain amount of weight, your body will start cutting back on energy expenditure, on your metabolic rate. This is a natural consequence of weight loss. And in fact, so there's two ways this happened. One is you have less body, right? You've lost some of your body. And so you have less energy needs to maintain that tissue. But the second one is these regulatory circuits in your brain, once you start losing fat, they start pushing back because you were at the body fat that they wanted you to be, this so-called set point. You were at your set point. You go below that and it's going to start pushing back and ramping up your appetite. And this is a major reason why people regain weight. But so, and part of that response is that your brain will start cutting back on your energy expenditure, your metabolic rate, more than would be expected just from the loss of tissue that you're experiencing during weight loss. So your brain is kind of turning down the thermostat on your metabolic rate. And so that can happen, but I'm not aware that that happens to specifically because of meal timing. It would be more like you've lost body fat, your brain gets the signal that the body fat's going away, and so it turns on this regulatory response to try to bring back the fat. Yeah. I do think that depending on what you're eating and your diet and your lifestyle, I do think that that compensatory response to weight loss can be reduced. So if you're eating a diet that is higher protein, lower palatability, if you're being physically active, I think those responses, the appetite response, the lower metabolic rate, I think those things can be dampened. But I don't know whether they can be eliminated. And I kind of doubt that. Yeah.
We all have been in situations where we have been under stress and we all know that we making rather unhealthy decisions when it comes to nutrition in those situations. So that's the behavioral aspect. But is there also like neuroscientific effect of a body under stress with like bad sleep or like mental health disorders. Is there also effect on how we are kind of processing food and calories and body fat when our body, our whole system is under stress and has some like mental health issues?
Yeah. So there are two mechanisms that I'm aware of that can come into play here. One of them is the secretion of the stress hormone cortisol. Cortisol can disrupt leptin signaling in the hypothalamus, and leptin is a signal that helps regulate our body fatness. And so cortisol can kind of dampen that leptin signal. And when you have a lot of cortisol, like if someone has Cushing's disease or they're taking certain cortisol-like drugs, that tends to cause people to develop abdominal obesity. So a lot of body fat in the belly area, they get puffy cheeks and they gain fat generally. There are researchers who believe that stress-induced cortisol, like more everyday levels of cortisol from stressful situations, can also contribute to that. I don't think the evidence is super strong, but I think you could make a decent case, because we do see that people who have high levels of stress in their life tend to have more abdominal obesity, as well as higher cortisol levels, and tend to gain weight more over time. The second thing it does is it shifts our food preferences. So, and this is essentially just self-soothing. So we know that when we feel stressed, eating so-called comfort foods can help us feel better. And the neuroscientific piece of that is that it's been shown in animal models that the neuronal activation in a part of the brain called the amygdala, that's the kind of fear and stress center, can be dampened by eating highly desirable foods. So, and it's not just foods. So we know, you know, from our own experience that if you feel stressed, there are a variety of things we can do. We could eat a delicious food. We could go for a walk. We could have sex. We could garden. There are different things you can do. And that research also shows that in animal models, both highly desirable foods and sex can dampen that stress response in the amygdala.
There are a lot of people who are trying to lose weight and then they are struggling with weight fluctuations and yo-yo dieting and stuff like that. What does neuroscience tell us about why it's so hard to actually maintain weight loss?
Yeah, so I think this comes back to the body fat regulatory system, which can be called the lipostat. I like to call it the lipostat. And you can think of this kind of like the thermostat in your house, where the thermostat in your house, there's a thermometer that's measuring the temperature. There's a set point that you're trying to keep the temperature at. And when it detects that the temperature has gone below that, it activates a compensatory response of heat, and then the temperature comes back up. If the temperature goes above that, it activates a compensatory response of air conditioning, and it comes back to the set point. So this is called a negative feedback system. So essentially, whenever it goes away from the desired level, there's a response that brings it back. And we contain a system like this for body fat. And it's in the hypothalamus, which is a part of the brain that does this type of regulation for a variety of things. So the hypothalamus regulates our body temperature, for example, and it's extremely good at it because our core body temperature stays within like half a degree Celsius all day. And so body fat is one of the things that the hypothalamus regulates. It's not as precise about it as regulating temperature, obviously, because especially over longer periods of time, our body fat can change quite substantially, usually going up. But the thing about it is that people with obesity are still regulating their body fatness. They're just regulating it at a higher level. So someone who is lean, if you cause them to lose weight, you're going to see the hypothalamus is going to activate this compensatory response. I call it the starvation response. Hunger goes up, interest in food cues goes up, metabolic rate goes down. You see the exact same thing in people with obesity when they try to lose weight. So what it looks like is that the set point has actually increased and is regulating around that higher level. And so this is a major reason why it's so hard to lose weight. Because a person with obesity who starts to lose weight, suddenly they're going to be struggling with this starvation response, even if they still have quite a bit more fat than someone who is lean. They're going to be fighting against the starvation response. Their appetite's going to be going up. Their metabolic rate's going to be going down. Their thinking about food, interest in food cues is going to be going through the roof. Cravings are going to be higher. And eventually, for most people, it just wears them down. And their calorie intake goes back up and they regain most or all of the weight that they lost. And that's what we see in randomized controlled trials and tightly controlled studies of dietary interventions. People typically achieve maximum weight loss around 6 months from the beginning of the program, and then they gradually regain. And by 12 months, typically they've regained most of the weight they had lost. It depends on the intervention, depends on how intensive it is, how much support people are given. So you can get better results than that, but it's very rare to see a study where you would see the majority of weight loss maintained through 3 years. I'll put it that way. Even in very good studies, you're not usually going to see that amount of weight maintenance. And the reason is people are just getting worn down by these systems that are opposing the weight loss.
You are half French, so you're very aware of a concept we like to call Genuss, the pleasure in eating, which is deeply embedded in the French, but also German culture. How do you view the balance between mindful eating and the risks of overindulgence?
Yeah, I think that's a really difficult question. I think, you know, everybody wants me to say, oh, you can eat, you know, delicious food and it has no impact on weight. I feel like there are so many kind of diet books that have this line in them somewhere, eat the most delicious food of your life and lose weight. But I think the two are tied together somewhat. I think the pleasure of eating is tied together somewhat with calorie intake and body fatness. But I think traditional food habits have other things that go along with them that tend to disfavor obesity. I think that the focus on meals and less focus on snacking, like I can't speak for Germany, but when I was growing up, no one ate anything in between meals. We ate at meals and there was nothing at all between meals. Whereas in the United States, people snack a lot. Like if you look at data on this, and this is something that has changed over time with the obesity epidemic, snacking has become much more prevalent, including sugar-sweetened beverages between meals. So I think that's one thing that's more associated with traditional food cultures is there are more norms around eating and when it's appropriate to eat and when it's not appropriate to eat. And then also there's more diversity of types of foods. Like I remember when I was growing up, oftentimes we would start the meal with either a raw vegetable or a fruit. So at lunch, we would have melon almost every day. We would have a cantaloupe melon before eating. And then often we would have radishes with salt or some other kind of raw fava beans or something like that. So I think, you know, when you're eating a wide diversity of foods, including, you know, fresh, lower calorie density foods, and you're mixing that into the meals, that tends to mitigate things. But I think that, you know, French cooking is associated to a large degree with kind of like, you know, cream and butter and heavier types of foods. And, you know, that's not wrong, but I don't think people are eating a lot of that every day. I think the more everyday foods tend to be lighter than that. And that's more like special occasion food. So, yeah, I think that's kind of where the balance is. I think if you're eating rich foods every day for every meal and every meal is like a celebration meal, yeah, I think that is going to contribute to increased body fatness, whether it's a hamburger or it's, you know, fine French or German cuisine. But if you're mixing it up with lower calorie density foods, if you have more strict norms around when it's appropriate to eat, and you're eating simpler food most of the time, which is what was my experience growing up in France, I think that's more compatible with lower risk of fat gain. Yeah.
We talked a lot about food, but do we sometimes also underestimate the impact of, let's say, the liquids we are taking in, soft drinks, alcoholic drinks, and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Alcohol is very calorie dense. So depending on what kind of alcoholic drink you're consuming, it's anywhere from 90 to 200 calories for one serving. So yeah, it's really easy for that to add up. 200 calories, that, you know, that's 7% of someone's daily calorie needs. And the difference in total calorie intake between someone who's lean and someone who is overweight is about 10%. So, you know, it doesn't take a lot of drinks to get you there. And then sugar sweetened beverages, that is one of the, of all the foods and beverages that people have studied for their association with fat gain, sugar sweetened beverages are one of the more consistently associated with fat gain. So I think calories from anywhere can contribute to fat gain, but sugar sweetened beverages are one of the worst because they don't seem to cause very much satiety at all. The satiety value is almost zero. Like, your body just doesn't register those calories in the same way that it would if you ate a piece of meat or a bowl of oatmeal.
As artificial intelligence becomes more integrated into health and nutrition, do you think we will see more and more personalized diets based on our brain chemistry in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, well, there's currently not a really good way to measure brain chemistry in people in the general population. I think maybe what would be more accessible is measuring your genetics and tailoring a diet to your genetics, which of course is a determinant of your brain chemistry. We're not at the point yet where we can personalize diets based on genes, but I have little doubt that it will be possible at some point in the future, because genes influence everything. So they influence how your brain is constructed. They influence how your body operates physiologically, and how your brain is constructed relates to what kinds of foods you crave, what kinds of foods might impact your satiety the most, how much willpower you have to make dietary modifications, probably what kind of dietary strategy is going to be the most effective for you ultimately. So I have little doubt that those things all have genetic influences and that those could be leveraged in theory to optimize diets for people. But I think we need more evidence before we can do that. So the genetics, yeah, so far attempts to craft diets for people based on genetics have not been successful. But we're at an early stage of understanding how these things relate to genetics. We have the tools to figure these things out right now with these large genome-wide association studies, but large studies will need to be conducted using these methods before we have enough data that we could design tools like this. But in theory, yeah, it should be possible eventually.
So if there is someone out there listening to our conversation and wants to make one immediate change to improve their eating habits, what would be your recommendation?
I would probably, if I were going to pick one recommendation, I would probably go for satiety per calorie. So trying to make the food that you're eating as filling as possible per calorie. There's actually an app that you can use for this called HAVA, H-A-V-A, and it will calculate its estimate of the satiety per calorie of the foods that you're eating. And it's just a really useful app. I recommend it for people who would like to try this out
Thank you so much for taking the time and all those insights into this very interesting topic.
Yeah, my pleasure, Daniel.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.